Hi, welcome to this week's program. My topic for today is, are you getting your financial news from a trustworthy source or not? Because nowadays, websites and blogs are inexpensive and easy to put together, and there's a lot of junk financial content out there that's not trustworthy at all, filled with junk claims and junk data, boosting all sorts of dubious and not-so-dubious securities. I guess I should call it fake financial news. You know, that's the term of the day, and I credit President Trump for giving me the idea for today's topic. Now, here's some hard data behind fake financial news. The SEC charged 27 individuals and entities with perpetrating a variety of stock promotion schemes. SEC investigators found that certain publicly traded companies had hired PR firms to promote their stocks under the guise of independent research, but failed to disclose the compensation aspects. So these articles were nothing more than paid advertisements. Stephanie Avakian, acting director of the SEC's Division of Enforcement, said, "If a company pays someone to publish or publicize articles about its stock, it must be disclosed to the investing public. These companies, these promoters and writers, allegedly misled investors by disguising paid promotions as objective and independent analysis." For example, in 2013, a publicly traded company called Galena Biopharma misled investors by commissioning over 100 paid articles that promoted Galena on investment websites, including one article on Seeking Alpha, where the author falsely stated that he had not been paid to write the article. Galena paid over $20,000 per month for these fake financial news articles and launched a 240-day blitz on social media sites like Facebook and Twitter, and they targeted to retail investors. None of those articles or posts disclosed that it was paid content. As a result, Galena shares jumped from under $2 to $7 per share, and Galena insiders profited handsomely by selling shares at elevated prices. The SEC filed charges and fined Galena and its CEO, but no one went to jail. So be wary of legitimate posts on well-known sites. Now, I'm not saying it's all fake, but there sure is a lot of fake financial news out there disseminated through a web of interconnected sites, which makes it hard to tell real from fake. So in some ways, while the internet has made stock research much, much easier, and it's empowered retail investors, the proliferation of fake news has made the role of the financial advisor all the more necessary, in my view. Necessary because most amateur investors need a grounded, credible person to help parse the good from the bad, to help you identify financial news that's trustworthy and credible. In another example, one hired writer hyped stocks under his own name and under at least 9 other made-up names. These names were Equity Options Guru, The Swiss Trader, Trading Maven, and Wonderful Wizard. And in one of his bios, he bogusly claimed to be an analyst and fund manager with almost 20 years of investment experience. So that's clearly a violation of authenticity and definitely qualifies as fake financial news. The SEC went on to find several publicly traded companies involved and still has a few cases pending. In addition, the SEC issued an alert warning investors to make investment decisions solely on the basis of articles published on investment research sites, but to research the company thoroughly using multiple sources. Amen to that. Now, I'm going to add that the SEC's own website is a great source of genuine company data information that public companies are required to report quarterly, and I'll make sure there's a link on my website. All you have to do, though, is go to the SEC's EDGAR company filings, E-D-G-A-R. You go to the website, SEC's EDGAR company filings website, and enter the company's name or ticker symbol to get information. And best of all, it's completely free and 100% trustworthy. Now, while fines are a bit of a deterrent, I think the SEC only got to the tip of the iceberg. Probably doesn't have the resources to chase down investment scammers that are often based outside the U.S., hiding behind anonymous servers in the dark web. So the SEC's enforcement actions aren't going to stop fake financial news. And that's why I'm talking about this right now. If you come across a story that makes a stock look extraordinarily attractive, don't get overexcited and rush to buy. Instead, take a deep breath. See if there's any fine print that says the post is a paid advertisement or that the author owns shares in the company. If there is proper fine print, that's good. If the post appears too bullish and there's no fine print, then treat that as a red flag. Also, check the author's bio. Google his or her name to see if it's a ghostwriter or a pseudonym, or if the author is genuine and credible. If everything checks out, it could still be fake financial news because scammers always get more sophisticated when law enforcement gets involved. So dig deeper to see if that stock is worth adding to your portfolio. Next, go to websites such as Google Finance or Yahoo Finance or your brokerage firm. Type in the company's name or ticker symbol and check its valuation. Check its price-to-earnings ratio, its recent news, its most recent earnings press release. Do your own due diligence to decide if a stock is attractive and figure out what that due diligence is so you can get to it right away. Now, here's something else you should know. Most brokerages are members of the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, easier said as FINRA, and cannot knowingly publish false or misleading information. Moreover, their publicly available content has to be carefully screened for fairness and balance. So, using your broker's website to research stock is always a safer bet. On the flip side, online publishers of financial news that are not FINRA members are not bound by FINRA's balanced and fair guidelines and could publish stuff that is biased, untrue, and knowingly misleading. So, watch out for fake financial news from such non-FINRA sites. Google and Yahoo Finance sites also give you links to articles on the stock. Read articles from multiple sources over at least the past 3 months to get a better picture of the company. The good news here is that buyers and sellers of the same stock often present and publish very different views on the same company. I like that. So looking up different sources will give you a good sense of the stock's pros and cons and alert you to what is fake financial news and what is not. And if you're a serious investor like Warren Buffett and his ilk, you should also read the company's quarterly financial filings, also known as the 10Q, and their annual reports, known as the 10K. And you can find those at the SEC websites, and you can also get them through links from Google and Yahoo and other sites. Look at the CEO's comments. Look at the CFO's comments. And look up the company's revenue, their earnings, earnings per share, debt levels, and cash flow. And look for patterns over the last few quarters to see if they match the investment research site that's promoting the stock. If everything still looks good, maybe you should consider buying the stock. If you have a financial advisor, consult him or her about how this stock would fit in to your overall financial portfolio goals. And get a trusted second opinion. Then invest with peace of mind and the confidence that you're not a victim of fake financial news. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. With employment running at 5.1%, according to government statistics, I wanted to drill down a little further to see what compensation was really like for many professions and get an idea of if wages were expected to rise this year or really what the condition of the labor market was. So to this effect, I've invited Paul McDonald. Paul is Senior Executive Director for Robert Half, and he joins me today to discuss. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you, Steve.
Hey, Paul, quickly for those who don't know Robert Half, what is this company?
Robert Half is a staffing company that was established in 1948, and we focus in on the professional level of placement, temporaries, permanent direct hire placement, in the areas of accounting and finance, technology, creative and marketing, administrative and office support, as well as legal. And as I mentioned, 1948 was when founder of the company, Robert Half, formed the company. We're based in Menlo Park, California, and we're publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange.
Oh, okay. Very good. So you guys really do know what's going on with wages. You see, you negotiate, you help place people in different positions. What would you say the state of the condition of the labor market is today in your particular areas?
Sure. We're a worldwide company, and I'll focus in on the United States at this point, you know, for context.
Sure. Good.
We're finding that the companies are finding it difficult to hire in the areas that we specialize in.
Mm-hmm.
It's a war on talent, and that war is indicative of the unemployment rate as published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. You know, the broad-based unemployment, as you mentioned, is in the mid-fives for the past 12 months, and it's been coming down. But when you drill down into that number, Steve, you find that unemployment rates for our areas of specialization, accounting and finance, technology, in the 2 to 3% range. So the balance, if you will, is on the job seeker or the employee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the company looking to hire individuals is really finding it difficult to find some of the most specialized talent today.
Yeah, so if the employee is the buyer, let's say, it's a buyer's market at this point.
I would say that's accurate.
Yeah.
And we're finding that in terms of salary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our predictions, as you mentioned, are we're going to talk about wages. Since 1950, Robert Half has put out a salary guide. And we're looking at 2016 as an overall increase in our areas of specialization at 4.1%.
Mm-hmm. How does that compare?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at it from last year, it's 3.8% what we looked at for 2015. And that's coming true right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're finding that with our clients and the placements that we're making.
So what are the issues that are driving this? Obviously, technology is very active and very robust right now. We all hear about technology companies and really the golden age we seem to be experiencing in that area. You mentioned finance as well. Is it a lack of qualified employees that's driving up not enough supply, or is it just so much demand?
Well, it's a little of both. I would say from a company perspective, when you look at technology, companies have been investing in technology for the past decade, for the past 15 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
It's not slowing down in terms of the investments. So every organization, every area within an organization needs people with technology skills. It's baseline knowledge today for those that are in the job market. We're seeing all companies demand technology of some sort in the job description today. So that investment is driving the need for big data engineers or big data scientists, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't heard much about big data, you know, maybe a decade ago, but now that we've invested so much, we've seen our companies and clients invest so much in technology, they need to know what to do with the data, how to sort the data, what does it mean in terms of customer behavior, client behavior. Everyone is looking for big data engineers, analysts, scientists. And the other side of it is mobile applications and mobile application development.
Mm-hmm.
Organizations that are servicing the community are everything mobile. So they want to be found. So that means that their product or their service needs to be found through a smartphone or a PDA device.
Sure, I get that.
And as a result, we're finding a lot of demand in that area.
What about demand for those in the executive suite? What kind of skills are looked for in that area?
Well, in the executive suite, I mean, as you move up the organizational chart in any C position, we're finding that obviously you have to have competency in directing, in supervising, in managing. And that hasn't changed.
Yeah, that's nothing new.
I find what is more highlighted today is the ability to collaborate. The true leader is a collaborator, someone who has a great command of the language, skillful in front of a crowd, and then moves quickly. Today's environment, work environment, business environment, as things happen, it's never before seen speed. So you have to be able to adopt new technologies, new ways of doing things, and be truly lead change,
mm-hmm.
a change agent.
Well, you know, a lot of those characteristics can define someone who runs a small business too, being able to handle all kinds of change as it's coming at them at light speed. So in a sense, it's no different. It's just your ability to lead and ability to kind of, you know, move the organization towards the future. You mentioned the salary guide, which I found really informative and incredibly fascinating. And by the way, you can find that salary guide on the Robert Half website. And yes, the last name is Half, like half of a whole, that type of half. And also we'll post it on our On the Money website, or if you come to onthemoneyradio.org and request it, we'll send it to you as well as a PDF link. What are some of the features of that salary guide? What can a person expect to find when looking through it?
Well, I would say, you know, I touched upon technology real quickly. You know, we have a guide for each one of the five specializations in which we focus in on. The accounting and finance guide, I think what you'd find is that average salaries, starting salaries for 2016 are expected to rise 4.7%.
Mm-hmm.
And truly the demand is coming from a few areas. Business systems analysts are in demand, staff accountants, financial analysts, and as I mentioned before, advanced technology skills, certifications, and specializations in industry really are commanding higher salaries. What's driving a lot of that accounting and finance need would be the regulatory environment that we've operated in the past few years and the corresponding compliance with those regulations.
Mm-hmm.
So always in need has been individuals with securities exchange background, reporting analysts. Dodd-Frank is driving some of that, as well as some of the international banking laws. So we're finding that, again, unemployment rates in that area are extremely low and the demand is high.
What about the need for legal employees that specializing in legal affairs?
The need for the legal, in the legal field, you know, starting salaries are anticipated to rise 3.1%. What's driving there is, again, there's compliance area, there's a lot of acquisitions and mergers and sales that have happened in the past 12 months, which will continue.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of changing of business hands. That drives the need for attorneys. Specifically, we're seeing the highest need in the 4 to 9 year range for these attorneys with experience, but that middle band is going to command the highest starting salaries next year. Additionally, e-discovery, the electronic discovery within matters, legal matters, suits, so forth. You know, the computer is allowing these individuals, either the plaintiff or the defendant, to be able to find data, again, back into the technology arena and be able to extract that and then know what to do with it. That's that e-discovery area is truly driving a lot of demand.
My guest is Paul McDonald, Senior Executive Director for Robert Half, and we're talking about the 2016 salary guide. Unfortunately, Paul, we are out of time. But for more information about this, you can join the conversation at onthemoneyradio.org. Ask us and we'll send you the guide, or you can go to the Robert Half website and it's prominently displayed. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good day.
Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. In light of a recent segment we just posted about how to find your dream job, I've invited back Paul McDonald, Senior Executive Director of Professional Staffing Services at Robert Half. And I asked him back to explore the other side of the hiring transaction the point of view from the employer. In other words, we want to know how an employer can find his or her dream employee. So let's see where this takes us. Paul McDonald, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
So what are some of the challenges that employers experience when seeking to hire?
Well, at this point in the hiring process, with unemployment where it is, a 17 or 18 year low, we're finding that in the United States, employers are having a tough time finding the right candidates, even to interview. There's a number of sources that they're going to that we can chat about. But in the areas in which we serve, accounting, finance, technology, creative, legal, and skilled administrative staff, we're hearing from our clients that they're pulling out all the stops, all the strategies that they've ever heard of or thought of, you know, from employee referral programs to hiring us to help them find the people, to moving people around internally and hiring maybe 70% of the job description and training up on the rest.
I gotcha.
Boy, there's so many different strategies that they're executing on right now because of the unemployment at such a historical low.
How do these sites like Monster.com, these employment listing sites, how do they fit into the picture and how effective do you think they are?
Well, it's one piece of the puzzle. You know, it's like we coach all of our clients to do it all. So number one, post your job on your own website, which then can move out to one of those aforementioned job boards. Make sure that it's snappy. Make sure it's interesting, that job description. Make sure it's realistic. What we're finding many of our clients as they come to us for coaching and advice, they're asking for this person that doesn't exist. For instance, we had recently a company looking for a coder, somebody that in technology arena. They were asking for 3 years of experience in a certain software language. Well, that software language was only a year old. So we work with them to make sure it's a realistic, accurate job descriptions with must-haves and then nice-to-haves bifurcated out.
What is the cost to an employer of making a bad decision? You guys have done numerous studies on this.
Oh, my goodness. The cost of a bad hire, it's a multitude of factors. One, think about the person, you know, you invest in training.
Yeah.
So there's in the investment cost that you do in training and bringing that person on board. Number two, the morale impact. This is what most employers don't think about. The morale impact on your department and fellow employees. Say it's a disruptive hire. That can take people off their game and not only have a vacant seat of the person you just replaced or have to replace, but then also all the others, the morale and the time you have to invest in bringing those people back to high morale.
Yeah. You know, there is that point. I also think back in my own experience here with our company, you know, you hire someone and you invest a lot of time training. You really want to do your best to make them a great employee. And then they move on, or you just seem to have thrown all that time and those resources out the window.
Yeah, there's no question. We're finding companies are investing more time on the onboarding of individuals today. And that onboarding can be, you know, 10 weeks long, 13 weeks, 6 months long.
Yeah.
Depends on what level of skills that you're hiring in for.
Yeah. So once I have a hire, and let's say I find out after a period of time it's not really working out. I mean, it's not terrible, but it's not working out. Do employers have a tendency to hold on to people too long?
They don't like to admit the mistake.
Yeah. They don't want to hurt anybody's feelings either, probably.
Well, they don't want to hurt the, you know, it's a reflection on them as a manager for making the poor hire.
Good point.
But what happens is that, you know, they're finding 4 to 6 weeks in, they recognize that they made a mistake. But then it's taking them 2, 3, and 4 months to correct the mistake. And that's the piece where we're urging employers that if you've identified that you've made a mistake, act quickly and swiftly, because the downside is, like I mentioned before, the morale on the others in the department.
That's a great point. So generally speaking, well, you've got different size companies to think about. You've got the very small, you've got the medium size, and you've got the large. Is hiring different based upon the size of the company and the number of employees?
Well, the complexity of the organization changes as it goes up in size. So you typically have a larger HR department, human resource department to help you out in the larger companies, mm-hmm. in the mid-sized companies. So as you go down to the smaller companies and some mid-size, they lean more on outside resources such as us at Robert Half to help them. We act as their recruitment arm, and we've been doing this for 70 years now of helping organizations identify professional talent, and they lean on us to be their eyes and ears to select and sift through the right candidates and serve them up either on a direct hire basis or on a temporary or contract basis, the proper employee.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a minute about, you know, what it means to hire a recruiter and what kind of questions to ask. With regards to these smaller and mid-sized corporations, you actually operate out of California. And I bring that up because, you know, California is kind of known for a lot of regulations and red tape and things you can say and can do and can't do. And it's a litany of regulations and so on. How much, in your view, being in the business, is that impacting the ability for companies to hire and to do business?
And you're right. We're headquartered in California, but we have worldwide operations and we operate in, you know, the states. I would say that we've adapted. The environment is, you know, one where there's ever-changing regulations. You know, some states are enacting or have enacted. You know, can't talk about past salaries or pay history. But, you know, it, you can tell from a skill set if the person's a good fit. You can tell when you interview them face-to-face or through Skype or FaceTime if they're a cultural fit for the client. So while the computer has helped us generate, and this is back to one of your previous questions, the computer helps and the technology helps identify people quickly and swiftly, you still need to have the personal touch in terms of sifting through the candidates. What you can and can't ask, that's going to be ever-changing. But you deal with it. It's still a face-to-face interview. It's still a cultural fit. It's still a technical fit that the clients are looking for. And it just, it's one of those things that, yeah, there might be a change here, but you adapt to it.
That brings up another point to me. So a lot of it is quantifiable. Do they have the correct skill set, the experience? But how much of it at this point is intuitive?
I would say intuitive. I'd say you need to have skilled individuals in your HR department, in your, you know, cadre of recruiters, for instance, us. Those people need to know what it is you're looking for from a hard skill standpoint, technology and technical skills specifically. But then they need to know the culture of the organization, because that's where the soft skills come in. That's where you're interviewing for fit. So this is what we're finding from a strategy standpoint. Some of our savvy clients are doing this, and we've been helping them do this. Job descriptions are, you know, they're 100% of what the person should or could be doing. We're finding that many of the clients today are taking advice and saying, okay, I'm finding somebody with 70 or 75% of what I need on the technical side, but they're hiring on the culture and soft skill side to see if they're a fit and if they're going to grow within their company for the long term. And then they'll train up on the rest.
Yeah, that's very good for an employee that's going out looking for work to realize as well.
Yes.
I guess I don't want to speak for you, but it seems to me you know, can kind of admit or see that you may have 75 or 80% of the skill set required, but you have the right attitude and the willingness to grow and to work. And I think at this point, that's because of the tight job market, that's probably a good thing. Before we run out of time, I want to ask you, so let's say that I decide I need a third party to come in and help me hire. What kind of questions would I ask a potential recruiter that I wanted to hire? And what, you know, so I don't know anything about your business. If you were on my side and I was trying to hire you, what would I want to know?
Yeah, I think that this is very important because this is usually where things fall down. First and foremost, I would advise employers. There's line managers, for instance, finance, accounting line managers that are trying to hire this individual and then be day-to-day managers over them. And then there's human resource individuals. The success formula is for those two parties internally to connect prior to coming to us and describe what's needed, what's going to be a really good person for us to hire, realistically hire. Then meet with us together. Meet with an outside source like Robert Half, either from the line management or HR or both preferably, and describe and come up with a project plan, if you will. These are metrics that we're trying to review. This is what we think we need. What do you think? You're in touch with the market on a regular basis. Are we realistic? What do we need to pay? What's the competition doing here, you know, in our surrounding area? And again, I'll go back to be repeating, but am I being realistic? Because that's typically where things fall down.
All right.
Maybe they haven't hired in 3 or 4 years. The market is changing on a quarterly basis for many of the people. Unemployment rates might be at 4.1% on a national basis. For many of the skill sets that we see, it's at 2% or less than 2%.
I got to stop you there, Paul. Unfortunately, we are out of time. My guest, Paul McDonald, Senior Executive Director of Professional Staffing Services at Robert Half. And by the way, they have a salary guide that's available online. You can get to it at roberthalf.com/salary-guide. And I think that's pretty cool. And if you want to hear more about this segment, about all the segments we do, don't forget to go to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. Thanks so much, Paul. Appreciate you being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in sunny Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
It hasn't been too sunny here lately, has it?
No, it hasn't.
But it hasn't been cold, I will say that.
That's right.
It has not been cold. All right, let's get started here. So we saw good housing price gains in 2017. What is the National Association of Home Builders, the NAHB, saying about 2018?
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be very favorable. We've got newly enacted tax laws, which created a favorable tax climate for businesses, which should spur jobs and economic growth and, you know, keep single family home production moving upward. So, you know, that's all good. Any kind of ongoing job creation, expected wage increases, et cetera, should also keep the housing market moving forward.
You know, last week we saw Walmart announce they were going to raise their minimum wage to $11 an hour based on the tax cuts they were getting. So they were reemploying some of that money back to their employees. So that's kind of a good sign. It's an initial sign. We'll have to see if, you know, more companies follow suit. But Walmart is a huge employer, so
yeah, absolutely.
It's pretty meaningful. And the more money people have in their pocket, it ripples through the economy. So, you know, things in that case are looking up.
Yeah. And there's also some regulatory costs stemming from the, you know, newer building codes, land use, environmental, et cetera. That's actually jumped up 29% in the past 5 years. Mm-hmm. So that actually has a significant impact on the housing affordability. And then there's something else that's really, a lot of people don't realize, but there's been a trade issue between Canada and the United States on softwood lumber. And this situation has actually increased the cost of this lumber 20% just in the past year. So that has an impact on the housing market.
Yeah, so there's good news and bad news. It looks like the economy is doing well. It looks like it's gaining some significant momentum on the one hand. But on the other hand, costs are also rising. So it's a mixed bag.
Yep.
What is the NAHB saying about mortgage rates? Because we're starting to see interest rates rise. What are their predictions for 2018 and 2019?
Well, what they're saying is, you know, as the economy continues to strengthen, you can expect that the average 30-year fixed rate mortgage will be around 4.31% in 2018, and then see another increase to about 4.82% in 2019. That's what they're predicting. No one knows for sure.
Well, predictions in the interest rate world are not really worth that much.
Right.
But it's something.
It's a trend that it's going to be moving up.
Yeah. So last year, I think the average was probably around 3.75.
Yep, that's
and
about right.
So they're saying 4.3. So let's call it a 0.5% rise or so in interest rates. So they're still historically incredibly low.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's not something you should be, if you're looking to buy a home, it's going to make it a little bit more expensive, but still historically speaking and relative to inflation, it's a very, very good rate. All right, digging deeper, you know, it's one thing for the NAHB, the National Association of Home Builders, to make predictions and to give us information. But insurance companies also play a part here because they actually have to put money out. So they have to keep a good accounting on costs. Now, I know Nationwide Insurance had some ideas about what the health of the real estate market is nationwide. Tell us about that.
Sure. They're saying that the vast majority of the local housing markets are healthy and faring well. They actually listed 324 markets as positive, 69 markets as neutral, and only like 7 of them as negative. So, you know, that's all really good news. One of the concerns that they do have, though, is that the prices are rising rapidly, and that draws a concern to them.
Yeah. So we have, on the one hand, again, good national numbers, healthy markets, but as the home prices rise, there's a serious question about affordability, and then wages have to rise at a certain rate in order to keep up with that. So they're saying they're worried about that too.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So how does this all compare to the housing boom a decade ago? I mean, we've got a healthy housing market, so I think we've made that case.
Yep.
But is it anything like 10 years ago?
No, and here's why. You know, the market is supply constrained today, and it was not during the boom. And the mortgage credit, while it was more readily available than just a few years ago, it still remains fairly limited in many of the marketplaces. So basically what you're looking at is the reason why prices are rising is due to a limitation of the supply of inventory. So there's constraint on the amount that's available. And there are controls on what they're lending and how they lend money out in today's market than we saw during the crazy decade of the booms.
So you're just saying, and you were part of both, so it doesn't even feel close to what was going on.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
I just wish we had more inventory to sell.
Yeah, I know you do.
If we did, then I think the prices would continue to rise. There's a pent-up supply of buyers and sellers. Many sellers are out there wanting to sell, but they don't know where they're going to go. They can't find anything for sale, so they're not putting their home up for sale.
Like a catch-22.
Yeah, very much catch-22 scenario.
I remember after the housing bust, we were sitting around and there was no business whatsoever. There were plenty of, I guess there were houses for sale and they were for sale at very low prices, but we had, you know, the market had its issues and problems back then. And now 10 years later, we're on the other side of the spectrum and prices are rising, but you know, there's so few houses for sale that, you know, people aren't selling. But I promise you, Terry, I promise you that when I sell, you will get my account and I'll be one house out of many, maybe that will be for sale. So what's happening in your neck of the woods in terms of latest sales? Anything particularly interesting?
You know, since, you know, the New Year's, we've seen a tremendous amount of interest. I've put on several homes for sale. A lot of people calling, wanting me to come out and give them an evaluation of their home. So I really believe this is going to be a real strong year. You know, I feel it, I hear it, and I've been going out on the appointments, and I really think we're going to see more sellers putting their homes up for sale.
Okay, well, hopefully that's not wishful thinking.
I got a great story. I had a guy from 29 years ago, he was one of my very first sales, call me and said, I don't know if you remember me, but I told you I would call you when I would sell my house. And that was
29 years ago?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So that was a great story for me.
Well, you've been in the business for 29 years, as we say in the very beginning. So he must have been your first client.
Yeah, he was the first 4 months.
Wow.
And I don't know if he realized that, but I told him.
That's amazing. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. And she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks a lot, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
When I meet listeners to the show as I'm out and about, so many mention the song we play before each Terry Story segment. You know, the Little Boxes song, Little Boxes on the Hillside, you know? I was on a plane a few weeks ago and I was thumbing through my playlist and there it was. So I listened to the entire song, which I hadn't done in a really long time. I had forgotten that this song was really a protest song and political satire about the conformist middle class attitudes of the 1950s and 60s. So, kick back and do a little time travel with me to the wonderful 60s. Here we go.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one. And they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university where they were put in boxes and they came out all the same. And there's doctors and lawyers and business executives and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martinis dry and they all have pretty children and the children go to school and the children go to summer camp and then to the university where they are put in boxes and they come out all the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family in boxes made of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. My next guest is Jonathan Clements. He is the founder and editor of Humble Dollar. You know, Jonathan spent almost two decades at the Wall Street Journal, and he was the personal finance columnist there. Very well respected, very well known, kind of an institution at the Wall Street Journal. And he's got his latest book out called How to Think About Money. Hey, Jonathan. Glad you're here. Always love to have you. Welcome.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me back on the show. I really appreciate it.
You know, you sent me the running list of your tweets. And, you know, normally I would think, you know, that would be just okay. But these were particularly funny and covered many of the common investing conundrums. So I thought we'd go through them. What do you say?
Sounds like a plan.
Well, before we go on, tell me how these tweets come out. Are they daily? Or are they just when you get an idea? How did they even develop?
So I launched this website, humbledollar.com, just over a year ago. And when I was having the site built, my web developer, James, said to me, hey, you know, why don't you have a mission statement across the top of the homepage? Well, you know, if you're a journalist, the idea of having a mission statement seems absolutely absurd. But then I thought, well, how about just putting up, you know, one thought every day? So I started putting that thought up, and then I had the site coded so it would go straight to Twitter, and then from Twitter, it goes straight to my professional Facebook page, the Jonathan Clements Money Guide. And so I got into on a roll and started putting these up every day. I've been collecting them, and I have vague plans at some point to turn them into a book. Uh-huh. But for the list that you saw, I pulled together 41 of the ones that I thought were particularly good and happy to talk about them.
All right, let's go to number one. Here we go. We get just one shot at making the journey from birth to retirement. Flirting with financial disaster is not advisable. When you say flirting with financial disaster, what do you think of when you say that?
There are all kinds of excessive risks we can potentially take. We can bet everything on one or two stocks or on a single sector of the stock market. We can buy stocks using borrowed money, in a margin account. We can not have any disability insurance. We can not have any life insurance, even though we have a family that depends upon us financially. All of those things invite financial disaster. It may be that you can get through your entire life and not suffer the consequences of this foolish behavior. Maybe you'll never need your disability insurance. Maybe your family won't suffer because you don't have life insurance. But you are running a major risk, and that risk could derail your chances of successfully making it in one piece financially from here to retirement.
You know, I remember back in 06, the fact that a lot of people were mortgaging their homes to buy other homes. There was a period when the stock market was hot and you'd hear about people pulling the equity out of their homes to buy stock. There are some anecdotal stories now about people doing the same, borrowing money to buy Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. I think this is what you're talking about with flirting with disaster. While things are good, you may feel rich and make a lot of money, but as soon as things start to turn around and go bad, so many things can happen that can destroy your financial life.
And the sort of added point to make here is these are risks you don't need to take. Mm. If you do the sensible things, you save regularly, you diversify broadly across the stock and bond markets, if you make sure you have a reasonable amount of insurance, everything's highly likely to turn out okay. Yeah. So why take these risks? They are unnecessary.
Yeah, so actually you talk about saving. So here's a tweet. Picking superior investments is a crowded trade. Saving more is an easy win. First of all, what does a crowded trade mean?
A crowded trade in Wall Street terms means a lot of people are trying to win at this particular game. And one of the games that a lot of people are trying to win at is beating the stock market averages.
Yeah.
There are, by one estimate, 1 million professionals around the world trying to figure out which stocks are going to do better than average over the next year.
Yeah.
So when you go out and try to buy investments, that's who you're competing against. And the reality is you don't need to beat the market in order to accumulate a decent amount of wealth. I mean, you look at those long run performance charts of the broad market indexes of the S&P 500 or of the international markets, if you simply captured the returns of those broad indexes, you would be extremely happy over a 20 or 30 year period. So why take the added risk of trying to beat the market?
You know, let me stop you there. The other part of this tweet, though, I want to concentrate on this idea that saving more is the easy win. Now, when people come to see me and they want to start investing, I think the first thing that they need to know is that most of your wealth is going to be created through your savings, especially when you're starting out. If you earn a 10 or a 20% return, I'm going to be ridiculous, but say on $100, you know, so that gets you to 120 bucks. That's not making you wealthy, but it's that $100 a month that you're putting away or more or saving in your 401k that builds up the great wealth. And then later on, the returns really start to make a difference. Any comment on that?
No, you have it absolutely right, Steve. I mean, over the years, I've met thousands of everyday Americans who have managed to amass seven-figure portfolios. Many of these folks had modest salaries. Most of them were mediocre investors, but almost all of them shared one attribute in common. They were extremely frugal, otherwise known as cheap. Mm-hmm. They were great savers, and that's what drove their portfolio's growth.
Yeah, I totally agree. All right, here's one. If your kids can borrow it or your friends can admire it, it doesn't count as an investment. Tell me about that.
You think about the things that we buy trying to kid ourselves that they're investments. You know, we buy the fancy car. We buy the second home. We buy the lovely piece of art that hangs above the fireplace. If you buy something and it delivers a lot of psychic income, you really enjoy having it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't count as an investment.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's, let's just say 99.9% of the time, that's probably true. It's that 0.1% of the time that we all dream about that's unlikely to happen. And that makes that, like buying the art, a great investment and so on. Here's another one. Draw up a list of your greatest pleasures in life. Then ask yourself, do you need great wealth to enjoy any of them?
And I actually wrote an entire blog on this topic, talking about the things during my day that I really enjoy. And they are things like that first cup of coffee in the morning, or having a particularly good workout at the gym that leaves you feeling spent, or getting home at the end of the day and sitting down and having a glass of wine with my wife. Those are great moments during the course of my day, and they really don't involve having significant wealth. They are just things that we can all do, even if we earn modest incomes. So while we imagine that our lives would be so much better if we were richer, the reality is what we do every day that we really enjoy, most of it doesn't involve being super rich.
But you know what it does involve, and this is your next tweet. It involves being solvent. It involves making the right decisions so you're not buried in debt. And you wrote, when you're ill, you realize how great it is to feel healthy. Money is similar. When you're broke, you realize how great it is to be solvent. So being solvent is a big part of happiness.
I tell people that in terms of money and happiness, there are really three things that money can do for you. One, it can allow you to have special times with friends and family. Two, it can give you the financial freedom to spend your days doing what you love. And three, simply having money means you don't need to worry about money. Mm-hmm. So being solvent, having some cash in the bank, knowing you'll be okay if you lose your job, that sense that everything's going to be okay financially can deliver an enormous boost to happiness. Whereas if you're in the opposite situation, you don't have any money in your bank, you're not sure how you'd cope if you lost your job, you really don't have any money put away for retirement, that's going to gnaw at you. You're going to spend days worrying about money, and that is a real buzzkill.
Yeah. My guest is Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of Humble Dollar, and he's the guy that was at the Wall Street Journal for almost two decades with a personal finance column. Okay, so here's one that I liked. What's the difference between an equity-indexed annuity? So we're talking about investments here specifically. What's the difference between an equity-indexed annuity and an index fund? One needs an army of salespeople. The other sells itself.
If you look at the past 10 years, the net flows of money into actively managed mutual funds is actually negative. People have pulled more money out of actively managed mutual funds than they put in. By contrast, index funds, those plain vanilla, low-cost funds that simply track the performance of the market averages, those people have been buying like hotcakes. The amount of assets in index funds has exploded. Trillions and trillions of dollars have come into these funds. So index funds by themselves don't need an army of salespeople. People have woken up and realized that they are a great investment. By contrast, equity-indexed annuities, there are indeed armies of salespeople out there pushing these things because they pay huge commissions to the salespeople involved. So what's an equity-indexed annuity? It ain't an index fund. What it is it's an annuity, which is an insurance product, that will allow you to capture part of the upside of the stock market each year while providing some downside protection. Now, that turns out to be a not particularly good way to make your money grow over time, unless you happen to be the salesperson who sells it, because it's a great way for them to make a huge commission.
I think over time as well, you end up earning the return of a basic bond.
Yeah, because what happens with an equity indexed annuity is, one, you don't get the dividends that you would get if you owned an index fund, and two, the amount that you can make every year is capped.
That's right.
So even if the market is up 20%, you might only make 6. So the net result is, you know, you might make a maximum of 6 in any one year, and in years when the market is flat, you get 0.
And, you know, getting 0 for a year or two can really wreak havoc on anybody's returns.
You got to know, if somebody's pushing something so heavily, if they're making a 12 or 14% commission, if they're willing to pay for you to come and have dinner,
that's
to
right.
listen to
Remember
their pitch.
That, right? That beautiful invitation you get in the mail to the local steakhouse, you know, obviously they're paying a lot for that because they know if they can land one or two of these, they're going to make a big commission. Also, the commission is really, it's not disclosed. We don't really know. It's not transparent. It's not a good business, and people should stay away from these kinds of annuities for sure. Let's move on. A boat is not your financial friend, you say, but a friend with a boat is. I think we all can agree on that.
So I remember an article I read probably 5 years ago now, and the first list in the article was the three things people most wanted to buy, and there among the top three was a boat.
Mm-hmm.
Then later in the article, they had a list of the three things people most regret buying. And there among the three things was
a boat. Of course, right.
You know, we imagine a boat is going to be this sort of wonderful Sunday afternoon, sailing
right.
around the bay, soaking in the sunshine.
Right.
But instead, what a boat is it's something expensive that you buy, that you have to put away in the winter if you live in the, you know, the northern part of the country. It involves lots of maintenance. You never take it out as often as you like. And a couple of years down the road,
you sell
it for a fraction of what you paid.
Right. Now, I have to admit, I had boat fever at one time, approximately 8 years ago. And man, you couldn't talk me out of it. But I did the smart thing. There was a place locally here in South Florida that allowed you to pay a fixed amount for the year. And then you could just kind of call them and they'll have a boat ready for you. At the end, when you were done boating for that day, you turned the keys over, they cleaned it, and they put it away, and they were responsible for it. And it took about 6 months before I got over that fever, and I realized that this is really, for me, it wasn't very interesting. I don't fish. I don't really do much on the water. I don't water ski. So I did lay around in the bay, sail the bay, so to speak, but it lost its luster really quickly, and I was so thankful that I actually hadn't bought a boat. I just leased it for a year. At the end of the year, that was it. I was over. Move on to the next thing. All right, let's go on. If you keep investing simple and make it understandable, you'll lose half your audience who assume success lies in their own befuddlement. So tell me about that.
Essentially, Steve, this is the story of my mediocre career. Hey. I spent 30 years trying to make investing simple and understandable. And what I've belatedly come to realize is this is not what people want. What they really want are articles that sound super sophisticated and clever, so they can boast at the country club about this complicated strategy they're involved in, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Many people do not want to really understand what they're buying and much prefer to buy sophisticated stuff. Like that equity indexed annuity, like the hedge fund, like that fancy mutual fund that goes long some stocks and short the others. They don't really want to understand what they own.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but these can be found at humbledollar.com. Is that right?
That's correct. It's my January newsletter. If you go to the site and check out the newsletters, you'll find all 41 listed in the January edition.
Jonathan Clements, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's been my pleasure, Steve.
To hear this interview again, to listen to the full show, or get a summary of the vital lessons that we've learned here today, go to stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our weekly update, where we will send you important lessons from the show straight to your inbox. You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.